Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This year we mark the 150th anniversary of events that came to be known as Bleeding Kansas, and to be seen by many as the prelude to the American Civil War. It's the subject of a new book on the topic, Bleeding Kansas, Contested Liberty in the Civil War Era, and of our interview this week with its author, Nicole Etchison. That interview will be followed by another perspective on the events leading up to the Civil War by historian Michael Holt. But first, Dan Roberts joins us for another moment in time, this one focusing on the Civil War hero, John Singleton Mosby.
After Lee's surrender at Appomattox in April 1865, the Confederacy's premier partisan, John Singleton Mosby, like many Southerners, had to decide how to spend the rest of his life.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
John Mosby grew up in rural Virginia, graduated from the university in Charlottesville, and established a law practice in Bristol. When the Commonwealth seceded in 1861, he volunteered for service in the cavalry, fought in the First Battle of Manassas, and rose to the rank of lieutenant. An excellent scout, throughout the summer and fall of 1862, he conducted reconnaissance patrols for General Jeb Stuart in northern Virginia. When Stuart retired to Fredericksburg for the winter months, he left Mosby behind to conduct guerrilla operations behind the Union lines. He was very good at what he did, conducting raids against supply lines, railroads, wagon trains, and isolated Union outposts. So good that Fauquier and Loudoun counties were known as Mosby's Confederacy. He and his small band of partisans, while keeping his activities remarkably free of civilian casualties, kept Union forces off balance until the very end of the war. After the surrender, he resumed his law practice, this time in Warrenton. A practical man, like Robert E. Lee, he understood the implications of defeat and tried to accommodate himself and his community to the altered reality. He became friends with Ulysses S. Grant and supported his former antagonist for president. Mosby's neighbors turned their backs on the former guerrilla fighter. One even took a shot at him one night at the Warrenton Depot. Grant, concerned for his new friend's life, appointed him consul in Hong Kong, and Mosby served in other federal posts until his death in 1916. Research assistance by Ann Johnson at the University of Richmond. This is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, apropos the subject of our interview and commentary this week, legislation recently introduced in the U.S. Senate by Kansas Senators Sam Brownback and Pat Roberts would help ensure Bleeding Kansas's place in history by creating the Bleeding Kansas and Enduring Struggle for Freedom National Heritage Area. Sites from 24 Kansas counties would be included in this one area, all focused on events leading up to the Civil War. When we return, we'll look at those local events and their importance to the nation. This is Talking History. Years ago this year, in 1854, a series of events occurred in the Kansas Territory that many historians, including our guest this week, Nicole Etchison, believe presaged the American Civil War, which began 7 years later. Interviewing Professor Etchison is Talking History's Jim Madison, professor of history at Indiana University.
The unsolved question of the 1850s was whether slavery would grow and expand into the new western lands beyond the Mississippi River. Long before Fort Sumter, Americans shed their blood over that issue of slavery expansion, especially in the new territory of Kansas. In fact, the 1850s introduced the nation to the term Bleeding Kansas, and to the prelude there to the violence that would mark the Civil War. A new book with the title Bleeding Kansas, Contested Liberty in the Civil War Era, argues the struggle in Kansas was part of America's larger struggle, not just over slavery, but over conflicting interpretations of liberty for whites and eventually for blacks. The author of the book, Bleeding Kansas, is our guest today, Professor Nicole Etchison of the History Department at the University of Texas, El Paso. We're talking with Professor Etchison from her office on the campus in El Paso. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's set the stage for Bleeding Kansas with a brief description of the issues raised in that well-known Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, 150 years ago. Most of us learned about it in high school, but remind us what we know.
The most important thing the Kansas-Nebraska Act did was to remove the prohibition on slavery in that northern region of the Louisiana Purchase that later became Kansas, and Congress had put that prohibition there in the 1820 Missouri Compromise Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854 removed it and replaced it with this idea of popular sovereignty to let the settlers who were going to go into that region decide whether or not they wanted to have slavery.
So this idea of popular sovereignty is so very important. Just tell us a little more about what it was, what it was intended to do.
Stephen Douglas, the Illinois senator who wrote the Kansas-Nebraska Act and came up with the insertion of popular sovereignty into it, said that it was nothing more or less than the basic American principle of democracy at its finest. Let the people decide. He was also trying to solve a slight political problem. He couldn't get Southern senators in Congress to vote to organize a territory that was going to become free and that would possibly enter Congress's free states and vote against them politically. So he did two things at once, resolve that political problem, but do it in such a way as he thought was kind of the grand democratic principle.
This, Nicole, seems very reasonable, very democratic. You're going to let the people of Kansas Territory decide whether they want slavery or not. But it doesn't work. It leads, in a way, to bleeding Kansas, doesn't it?
Yes, and it didn't work, I think, for two reasons. First of all, the popular sovereignty, it assumed, as we do today, that democracy works flawlessly, that there will be no hanging chads, that everything will go perfectly. And in fact, in the 1850s, there were things that were not quite perfect. People tended to vote even when they didn't live in a territory because they expected they were going to move into it later. That's what the Missourians do. So there comes to be irregularities in the Kansas election. Some people would have said fraud with the Missourians voting when they shouldn't have. And then the second problem that popular sovereignty and certainly Douglas didn't take into account was the issue of whether or not you can resolve an inherently moral problem through the democratic process. Because no matter what the people decide, if some people think what they decided was immoral, they're not going to accept that decision. And people like that turned up in Kansas Territory. John Brown was such a person.
Right, and we want to talk about John Brown, but I think this reflects the subtitle of your book, which is Contested Liberty in the Civil War Era. What do you mean by contested liberty?
Well, the older interpretations of Bleeding Kansas have talked a lot about slavery, but there are no slaves, or very few, 190-some slaves in Kansas Territory. Some had talked about economic issues. And when I started going through the material, I found that both sides, the free state side and the pro-slavery side, were talking a lot about Bleeding Kansas in terms of a threat to their political rights. They felt threatened. The free staters felt threatened because with the election irregularities, they said, we're not getting to make this decision. The elections are being stolen out from under us.
By pro-slavery voters, many from Missouri, is that correct?
Right, right. Okay. By the fact that the Missourians were coming over and voting in large numbers when they didn't actually live at that moment in the territory. And the pro-slavery side increasingly argued that they had a constitutional right to have slaves and that the free staters couldn't take that away from them. They had a right to have slavery in the territory no matter what the free staters wanted.
So both sides saw this in terms of liberty.
Yeah.
Their liberty.
Yeah, their political rights as voters, as citizens, were being threatened by the way events were playing out.
All right, let's go to this moral issue of slavery and think about how the free state position relates to anti-slavery or abolitionism.
Well, not very many of the free staters were genuine abolitionists. The free state migration, a very small portion of it, in 1855, only 4% of the settlers in Kansas are from New England. And New England was the region most likely to send people consciously as part of an anti-slavery crusade. A huge portion, 47%, of the settlers in 1855 were from Missouri, and then another third or so were from the Midwest. And the Midwesterners tended to be more interested in just getting a farm. They tended, insofar as they thought about slaves, to not want slavery but not want blacks around either. They wanted black exclusion from Kansas. But I think that as events went on, and as the turmoil increased, more and more of the northern settlers began to make a link between what was happening to them and the slavery issue, and they got radicalized on issues of slavery and race.
And they moved toward the abolitionist, minority abolitionist position then as a consequence. Is that correct?
Yes, and the great example of that is Jim Lane, who was an Indiana Democrat who moved out into the territory, and he had actually voted for the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and it hurt him politically in Indiana. So he comes out to Kansas, and the famous story is that he declared when he first arrived in the territory that he would as soon buy a Negro as a mule, unquote.
Yes.
And then he goes on to become a radical Republican, to recruit black soldiers for the Union Army. So he goes through some kind of transformation.
Okay, how do we get then from this question, this difference between pro-slavery and free state positions in Kansas Territory, how do we get from that to bleeding Kansas, to violence?
Well, partly it comes out of the problems with the elections, which caused the free staters who felt they weren't getting to make the choice of popular sovereignty it offered them, so they create their own political process. They create an extra legal government, the so-called Topeka government, which causes the Missourians and the pro-slavery party and their allies to say, well, that's illegal, that's revolutionary. There is a territorial government controlled by the pro-slavery party. So you have these two different governments in Kansas Territory, and they are at odds. And then there are a couple of triggering events. One is the effort of the pro-slavery party to establish law and order, to suppress that extra-legal Topeka movement, which they try to do in the summer of 1856. And then the other kind of wild card is John Brown, the settler who's moved into Kansas Territory, who's a real fire-breathing, genuine abolitionist, who becomes frustrated by the kind of stalemate and decides that they have to use violence to resolve this. And so he goes out in May 1856 and kills some of his neighbors.
Actually murders fellow citizens. Is that correct, John Brown, in the name of abolitionism?
Yes. Some people debate whether Brown didn't actually pull the trigger or hack anyone himself, but he rounded up his sons and a group of followers, and they took five men out in the middle of the night and killed them under his direction. Some people would insist on that distinction. And the territory was in a very tense state at that point, and those kinds of incidents, the Missourians had attacked Lawrence a few days earlier, and then there's the murder of the pro-slavery settlers that Brown and his followers carry out, and that just sets everyone running around shooting at each other.
And this violence even reaches the floor of the United States Senate.
Well, yes, we like to think of the Congress as a place of great decorum, but in the 1800s, there were numerous times when congressmen and senators sort of went after each other. So, yeah, there's the famous brawl also in May of 1856 where a South Carolina congressman goes on the floor of the Senate and beats up a Massachusetts senator who had given a speech about Kansas and who had insulted the congressman's uncle, who was a South Carolina senator, in that speech.
And this senator is Senator Sumner, correct?
Senator Sumner is the Massachusetts senator,
yes,
who gets beaten up.
And he's really beaten up. I mean, how badly was he beaten?
Well, there's some debate about that.
Oh, is that?
Actually, one of his biographers thought it was more psychosomatic. He stays out of his Senate seat for a long time, and the people of Massachusetts reelect him to it, even though they know he's not physically going to be there, to make a statement that Southerners can't intimidate them. And again, the North saw the attack on Sumner as a free speech issue. He had spoken out and condemned Southerners, and they had physically attacked him for it. So by reelecting him, in a lot of the public statements, the time Sumner is attacked, people are talking about those Southerners are not going to stop us from exercising our right of free speech.
Yes. Let's go back to the free state people in Kansas. And you indicated earlier that they're really not, most of them at the beginning at least, abolitionists, and even some of them are what we might say racist.
Yes.
But that position changes, and with it becomes, you argue, the possibility of liberty for African Americans. Can you tell us how that works?
Yes, in 1855 and 1856, at the beginning of the Free State Movement, there are several incidents where Missouri blacks run away into Kansas. Summer of 1856, when Jim Lane was leading a guerrilla band in Kansas Territory, a runaway came to them, and Lane said, "We're fighting to free white men, not black men," and returned him. And that was happening. People in Lawrence, the New England settlement, returned slaves in 1855. But then, by the end of the decade, more and more of the Kansas Free Staters are willing to accept runaways, to help people get their liberty, to chase off slave catchers who are coming after them. And then during the Civil War, there's a flood of refugees, runaway Missouri and Arkansas slaves coming into Kansas. And then, of course, that culminates with the Exoduster movement after the Civil War in the 1870s.
And even African-American men in uniform fighting for the North from Kansas during the Civil War, correct?
Yes, Kansas was one of the first states to enlist black soldiers into the Union Army. And who gets the credit for first depends on whether you go with the official War Department records, because the War Department didn't really want them to do that in 1861. But Kansas can lay a claim to having been one of the first.
Yes. We have only a little bit of time, Nicole, and this is a complicated question, but I must ask you, reading your book, Bleeding Kansas, I get the sense that you suggest the Civil War might have been inevitable, that the possibility of compromise, of avoiding violence, was very slim, even non-existent. Is that right?
I guess the way I would put it is that it became harder and harder to avoid the Civil War. But I do think there were choices that were made. Douglas didn't have to introduce the Kansas-Nebraska Act. He didn't have to remove the prohibition on slavery. He reopened a whole question that many people considered closed. So no, without any Kansas-Nebraska Act, the 1850s would have played out very differently. But I do think one thing Bleeding Kansas did was to exacerbate the tensions, to radicalize people all over the country who were following this drama in their newspapers, and make it harder and harder to avoid the Civil War. But I'm not sure I'm willing to go as far as inevitable.
Okay, I didn't want to put words in your mouth. Thank you very much. We've been talking with Nicole Etchison, author of a new book, Bleeding Kansas, Contested Liberty in the Civil War Era, published by the University Press of Kansas. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
Our guest commentator this week, Michael Holt, has written another recently published book on events leading up to the Civil War. He joins us to offer his perspective on what happened in Kansas and why our knowledge of those events helps us better understand the origins of the war. Holt, author of The Fate of Their Country, Politicians, Slavery Extension, and the Coming of the Civil War, is a professor of history at the University of Virginia.
The turbulent events in or about Kansas Territory during the second half of the 1850s had a profound impact on national political life. Final passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act in May 1854 shattered the existing two-party system, featuring competition between Whigs and Democrats, and helped substitute a new, exclusively Northern and overtly anti-Southern, anti-slavery Republican Party as the Democrats' major opponent in American politics. Because the Kansas-Nebraska Act opened up an area from which slavery had been explicitly prohibited since 1820 to slavery extension, it ignited a furious backlash against the Democratic Party in the North. In the Congress that passed the act, there were 91 Northern Democrats in the House of Representatives. Yet in the congressional elections of 1854-55, Democrats lost 66 of those Northern seats. Measured another way, in the presidential election of 1852, Democratic candidate Franklin Pierce won 50% of the popular vote in the North. In 1856, Democratic candidate James Buchanan won only 41.4% of the North's popular vote. The electoral reaction against the Democratic Party in the North, in sum, was simply devastating. For three reasons, however, the Whig Party, Democrats' traditional foe, also suffered rather than benefiting from this anti-democratic backlash. First, because Southern Whigs generally voted for the Nebraska Act while every Northern Whig in Congress voted against it, what was left of the Whig Party split irreparably along sectional lines. Second, in four Midwestern states, Whigs abandoned their old party and joined new anti-Nebraska coalitions with Free Soilers and anti-Nebraska Democrats. In Michigan and Wisconsin, moreover, these coalitions adopted the name Republican Party in the summer of 1854. The creation of the modern Republican Party, in short, was a direct product of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. But third and most important, the big winner in the elections of 1854-55 was yet another new party, the anti-Catholic and anti-immigrant Know-Nothing Party, and by the end of 1855, many people predicted that this nativist organization, which, unlike the Republicans, also had considerable strength in the South, would elect the next president in 1856. Instead, the Republicans emerged as the Democrats' major opponent that year, and they carried 11 of the 16 free states. Republicans did so largely because of events in or about Kansas. The so-called sack of Lawrence in May 1856 and the simultaneous caning of Massachusetts Republican Senator Charles Sumner by South Carolina Representative Preston Brooks, after Sumner had delivered a speech called The Crime Against Kansas, gave Republicans an invincible combination of issues. Bleeding Kansas and bleeding Sumner drove the great majority of Northern Know-Nothings into the Republican camp. Well, Buchanan won a three-way contest in 1856 with only 45% of the popular vote. His attempt to force Kansas's admission as a slave state under the bogus Lecompton Constitution split Democrats between supporters and opponents of Stephen A. Douglas, allowing great Republican gains in the congressional elections of 1858 and contributing to Lincoln's election in 1860. Thus did Kansas affairs have a profound impact on national politics.
You've been listening to Michael Holt, author of The Fate of Their Country, Politicians, Slavery Extension, and the Coming of the Civil War, and professor of history at the University of Virginia. Finally, we end this week's program with another segment in the popular series, Hoaxes from History, which we've aired from time to time on Talking History. Our hoax historian is Alex Berza, the author of The Museum of Hoaxes, a collection of pranks, stunts, deceptions, and other wonderful stories contrived for the public from the Middle Ages to the new millennium, and the creator and curator of www.museumofhoaxes.com. This week, Berza tells us about the history of Crowland.
Crowland Abbey, located deep in the Lincolnshire Fens of England, was once a center for medieval religious life. Today, however, it lies mostly in ruins. A few quatrefoil window carvings and undamaged statues provide a sense of the building's former glory, but the abbey itself is less well known for its artwork than it is for an outrageous historical hoax that its former inhabitants once perpetrated. The abbey dates back to the early 9th century. For centuries, monks lived a quiet, solitary existence there, tending their crops and spending long hours in worship. But despite their devotion to solitude, the monks were not immune to the intrusions of the outside world. In particular, they had to guard against a steady stream of legal threats to the abbey property. These threats peaked during the early 15th century when a neighboring abbey claimed a portion of Croyland's lands as their own, resulting in a case that was brought to court in 1413. To prove that they had sole claim to the abbey's lands, the Croyland monks presented the court with a volume known as the Historia Croylandensis, or History of Croyland, that was a string of historical land charters woven together into a general history of the abbey. The history and charters were accepted as legitimate, the Croyland monks won their case, and the abbey, for the moment, was safe. But for later generations of scholars, the fact that the Croyland monks won their case was less interesting than was the history of Croyland itself, since the document provided a rare written record of centuries of medieval church life. By the 18th century, the history had become a widely quoted source for information about medieval monasteries. It was only in the 19th century that historians began to realize that something about the history was fishy. Their first clue was the names. They noticed that the history referred to numerous places and historical figures using 14th century terms, even in passages that were supposedly written in the 10th century. As they studied the document more closely, historians found even more discrepancies. For instance, it referred to monks who had allegedly studied at Oxford University in years before the university existed. It mentioned the construction of a triangular bridge in the 10th century, even though triangular bridges weren't invented until the 14th century. And finally, and most bizarrely, it credited the monks of the abbey with remarkable health, for according to the history, the monks had regularly attained ripe old ages, such as 115, 142, and even 148 years old. Either the history was a fraud, historians realized, or there was something very special in the water those monks were drinking. Historians decided it was fraud. To the monks' credit, the deception worked, but their luck didn't hold out forever. The next century, Henry VIII decided to dissolve England's monasteries. To avert this fate, the Croyland monks tried to win over the king's agents with a gift of sumptuous fish. But this time their ploy didn't work. The abbey was dissolved in 1539.
You've been listening to Alex Berza, author of The Museum of Hoaxes, a collection of pranks, stunts, deceptions, and other wonderful stories contrived for the public from the Middle Ages to the new millennium. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments and suggestions, which you can email to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or post to us at Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona B., the producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect those of the staff of Talking History or of the Organization of American Historians. For more information on Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. Their website is amomentintime.com. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.